choice and a few in the second choice. A couple, unfortunately, had to go to third choice for section. I'm trying to get this Riley Robb 225 room changed because that's a long hike for some of you, but it really is a crisis year at Cornell because of what's happened to Martha Van Rensselaer, the new part where the building is in structural trouble and they've had to evacuate it. So I'm not sure we'll be able to get a room that's closer than that. If you didn't get the four handouts at the Thursday class, I'll put them on the table up here. I didn't want to put them there to confuse you, but I'll put them here and you can get them at the end then. A couple of you have already told me that because of your changing schedule, you've had to shift a little on this section assignment. I will try my best to make it work for you, but again, in order for it to work well, you really have to be willing in a few cases to go into a second or third choice if you can make it, because otherwise the system doesn't work at all if you're not fairly responsible about taking a second or third choice if it's necessary to get everyone into a section. So we'll have a few more things at the end then. Let's see, Greg Heitzhusen, you weren't here on, would you stand up? This is our other TA, Greg Heitzhusen. He's been out sailing the last few days with his folks, I guess, was it? And Greg is a Cornell grad, actually, and also did a three-year program at Yale in forestry and religion and some of the interface between natural resources and religious and philosophical thinking. And it's just a delight to have Greg. He's, along with Jamie and one other student, is starting their PhD with me this fall. So we're really pleased to have you on board, Greg. Okay. I want to get back right into the lecture material and then a few more announcements at the end. One of the problems that we'll be wrestling with throughout the course is the nature of moral judgments. What does it really mean when we say this is right or that's wrong or this is just or unjust, or if we say of a particular action this is good or bad? These are what we sometimes call normative terms. They set norms. And there is a great deal of discussion among philosophers and moralists, theologians, and others as to what we would call the epistemological status, the knowledge status of moral judgments. What does it mean when you say something is wrong? Is that a claim that you can really back up or know to be true, or are you stating a kind of preference or what we sometimes refer to as a value judgment? And one of the more interesting discussions taking off on that issue was a book that was written over 50 years ago by C.S. Lewis called The Abolition of Man. And I thought Lewis's work would give us a kind of nice introduction to this particular issue. We're not going to read this book. We're going to read one of his novels, a science fiction novel, That Hideous Strength, that tries in a dramatic fashion to develop the thesis of this book. But the thesis here is really quite interesting because Lewis is objecting to the authors of what he refers to as the Green Book. He doesn't want to embarrass the authors. This is still an age of considerable courtesy and politeness. He doesn't mention them by name or even the title of the book. He calls it the Green Book. But these two authors argue throughout the book that moral claims are simply subjective preferences, that when you say something is good or bad, or if you say that Beethoven is a better musician than Bear, you're just making a value claim that's a kind of subjective preference. And Lewis starts with this problem and discusses it at some length. And then towards the the end of the book, in the chapter called The Abolition of Man, he raises some interesting questions. Actually, it's the chapter called, he starts with the title, The Conquest of Nature. And he asks the question, in light now of this discussion about the moral state or the knowledge status of moral claims, he asks the question, in what sense are human beings the possessor of increasing power over nature? We speak of our power over nature, our control of nature. He says, and I won't try to translate his language here. He speaks of man's power over nature. He's writing in 1946. He says, what we call man's power is in reality a power possessed by some men, which they may or may not allow other men to profit by. He suggests, for instance, that bombs represent a certain power over nature. But don't forget, he argues, that you may be on the receiving end of a bomb as well as on the delivering end. Contraceptives, genetic manipulation, selective breeding, through all of these, Lewis suggests that we gain a certain power over nature. And he wants to explore, what is this like? What does this mean when we say that human beings or man has power over nature? So he suggests a thought experiment. Thought experiments are very important in the humanities, because in the humanities we generally can't, for instance, take 100 children and beat up on them for 10 years and deprive them of love and nurture and malnourish them, and then take 100 and do all the right things and then compare them. We're just not going to do that with human beings. Some of us feel it's bad enough that we do those things with animals. So we engage in thought experiments, and to a considerable extent, drama, poetry, literature, some of the great novels, are in a sense thought experiments. In The Brothers Karamazov, or by Dostoevsky, or Tolstoy's War and Peace, or think of your own favorite novels, the author in a certain sense is asking what might happen or what might be the results if people live this way. Not necessarily in a deliberate fashion. I think particularly if you take an author like Dostoevsky, who wrote a chapter a week for the newspaper, he wrote under pressure. I think in a sense the characters led him as well as he creating the characters. I'm not sure it was a deliberate sort of moral tale or a kind of sermonic presentation. But in a sense, these are thought experiments. What might happen or what might life be like if people lived this way? And so Lewis presents a thought experiment to look at this question about the nature of moral judgments and man's power over nature. And he suggests that a generation arises sometime in the future, and it's very, very interesting. He sees this as about 10,000 AD. And, of course, he had no awareness of anything like DNA and RNA and genetic engineering and nanotechnology and so on, just the simplest kind of robotics at that time. So he sees this as about 10,000 AD, and I would suggest that it may happen in our in your lifetime, probably not in mine, but this incredible acceleration of time. He imagines a time about 10,000 AD where a generation arises that is able to design the human being of the future through eugenics and scientific indoctrination. That's the best Lewis had to work with in the 40s, that eugenics, or trying to breed human beings like we breed chickens and cows and so on, and psychological indoctrination. Both of them had made quite substantial advances, and he imagines that these become so advanced that at some time in the future we can actually design human beings. It's one of the reasons, incidentally, getting old is not so much fun, because I'm so curious about how things are going to turn out in 20 or 50 or 100 years from now. How could Lewis ever have imagined this incredible explosion of scientific knowledge in DNA and so on, with all of its incredibly positive potential, as well as its more troublesome, worrisome side. It would have been almost impossible to imagine that. But what he does imagine is extraordinarily interesting, and I think he asks exactly the right question. So he envisions this generation in the future that has a kind of high point of power over nature, and he says, what's likely to happen, he asks. In reality, he writes, if any one age really attains, by eugenics and scientific education, the power to make its descendants what it pleases through breeding and through indoctrination, all men who live after it are the patients of that power. Now, that may not seem obvious at first, but if one generation gets to a point where they really can begin to redesign human beings, then the human beings who come after that, to some extent, are the patients, or you could even use a more pejorative term, like victim, of that power, because they will have been designed in a certain way. And if it's done in a subtle enough way, it's not altogether clear that they could undo that, because they will have been designed to function in this way rather than alternative ways. They become the patients, he says, of that power. And Lewis then asks the question, will these human beings of the future be stronger than us? Will they have more power over nature than we have? And he argues that that's exactly what won't happen. He says, on the contrary, the last men, far from being the heirs of power, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the great planners and conditioners, and will themselves exercise least power over the future. That's not altogether intuitive. One, I think, wouldn't necessarily think of that. We think of humans having increasing power over nature, but he says these people in the future, counterintuitively, may actually have less power. He writes this. He says, the real picture is that of one dominant age, let us suppose the 100th century AD, which resists all previous ages most successfully and dominates all subsequent ages most irresistibly, and thus is the real master of the human species. And then he makes the scenario even tighter when he says that even among this generation, the power will be exercised by a small minority, those who possess political and scientific capability. We usually think of humans gaining more and more power over nature, but that's really not accurate. What the actual situation is that those who have the scientific and technological and political power, usually a small cadre, a small elite in any given society, they will have more power over nature, and through their power over nature, they will have more power over other people. Lewis refers to these people as the conditioners. They will be the masters of this future time. He refers to the omnicompetent state and the irresistible scientific technique. Let me read just a paragraph here, here from page 72. He says, human nature will be the last part of nature to surrender to man. No, I'm sorry, that's... let me defer that just for a moment. Okay, now Lewis adds a very, very interesting twist to this. Let me, here's the passage I was looking for. He says, in order to understand fully what man's power over nature, and therefore the power of some men over other men, really means, we must picture the race extended in time from the date of its emergence to that of its extinction. Each generation exercises power over its successors, and each, insofar as it modifies the environment bequeathed to it and rebels against tradition, resists and limits the power of its predecessors. This modifies the picture which is sometimes painted of a progressive emancipation from tradition and a progressive control of natural processes, resulting in a continual increase of human power. In reality, of course, if any one age really attains, by eugenics and scientific education, this is the passage I quoted, the power to make its descendants what it pleases, all men who live after it are the patients of that power. Now, Lewis adds an interesting twist to this thought experiment. He says, what if those in power, the scientists and politicians, those he calls the conditioners, what if they not only possess this great technological power, but what if they also believe there are no reliable moral standards which will guide them in how to use it? And he here is getting back to the authors of the Green Book who defend that thesis that moral standards and ethical rules and principles are all private and subjective. He says, what is likely to happen in this future scenario if there are no firm moral standards to guide the this technology is wonderful. Thank you very much, Jamie. Okay, now, what Lewis is suggesting then is a very, very counterintuitive result. If we can't make these decisions on the basis of believable and defensible moral standards, or another way of putting it, if we can't make these decisions on the basis of culture, but make them simply on the basis of impulses and preferences and instincts, this looks like we're going back to nature, and that results in a very, very odd situation. And the conclusion that Lewis reaches is that paradoxically, at the moment when we think we're conquering nature, exactly the opposite happens. Nature conquers us and indeed abolishes us. That is a very, very interesting idea, that if chance is in a sense inherent in nature, that in animals there's not a rational life plan, it's just as the feelings and instincts and impulses happen, and if that's the way you decide to live, rather than living more thoughtfully and rationally on the basis of tested cultural judgments about right and wrong, then counterintuitively, at this point where we have this incredible power over nature, it looks as if rather it's nature having power over us and in a sense abolishing us. I think that scenario is incredibly interesting, because in your lifetime, in my lifetime, this looks like it may be beginning. We have the power now to change our genome in incredibly drastic ways. May not have it all right today, but I think it looks like we will have this more and more. Is it not a very, very real danger in the process of doing this that we will, in some ways, abolish man, human beings, as we know them? Give me a few reactions here. Does that argument make sense? Or let me just elaborate on one thing and then some comments. I think it's extraordinarily hard for us today to realize how much of human history has been getting away from nature. when you control fire, when you begin domestication of plants and animals, when you build a shelter, when you do all kinds of things like this, in a way you're separating yourself from nature. Now, the irony in our own time is that we are more afraid, and I think rightly so, of the fact that we've separated ourselves from nature than we are of nature itself. It's our power over nature that scares us the most today, not nature itself, because we're afraid that things may get out of control and we may destroy ourselves. But within Lewis's framework, if we use this power totally apart from defensible, rational, moral standards, the counterintuitive result may be that nature may abolish us. I'd love some feedback, some questions or comments. Yeah, way in the back. You've said it beautifully. It is very scary. This is what I referred to in the Bill Joy article about robotics and nanotechnology and bioengineering. In my more pessimistic moments, I think it's possible that there have been intelligent civilizations spread throughout the universe. And if they were anything like us, they got to about our level of scientific and technical development and then self-destructed. And that's why we haven't heard from them, because that period from the strong beginnings of science, and particularly when you get to radio and so on, till destruction was very brief. I think we live in an incredible period. And I think you've summed it up very, very well. What can you say? Yes.
When Lewis said that the culture of joyfulness has been suppressed by time, well, you said it yourself, that's the culture of judgment of right and wrong, as opposed to the impulse. First of all, I assume that by the culture of judgment, we mean the culture of judgment of Western society. So different societies have somewhat different cultures. Way of thinking, way of judging. But I don't really buy that they were tested, because if you look at human history, specifically history of the Western society, which hasn't been so long, because we agree, of wars, acquisitions, you have racial cleansing, persecution. On the other hand, look at the animal society and tell me which is better.
You know, your point is very important. That's why I said in the lecture on Thursday that it's sometimes I can envy the animals, because they don't engage in this introspection and asking the question, how should I live? In some ways, when the forebrain gets as big as it is, it brings huge benefits, but it also, as you nicely point out, brings huge problems. Now, one of the issues we're going to look at in the course is it true that moral judgments in different societies differ as much as you might gather being a student at Cornell? And I'm going to try to present evidence, I will present evidence, that I think persuasively argues that that's not true, that there's a great deal more homogeneity in basic moral judgments than we often think. But yes, that's again the kind of question that we would have to ask. Human beings have really screwed it up in a lot of different ways. In fact, the very next section of the lecture touches on that a little bit. Yes? Wow, you.
Right.
You are asking tough questions. We're going to, believe it or not, we're going to talk about that. And again, the problem is you can't say everything at once. You have to sort of start some way. Now, maybe I've succeeded just if I've gotten you to ask these questions, because these are some... You've asked some of the key questions that the Course is going to deal with. Can you sort out among the traditions? Is it true, as the postmodernists argue, that all these traditions are, come see, come saw, it's just a matter of political power, the person with the biggest stick enforces the right morality? If any of you read the book that was assigned to Cornell freshmen, Guns, Germs, and Steel, the author argues that priests and the religious establishment is pretty much just in cahoots with the state, and they both together form a massive kleptocracy which just steals from people and so on and so on. We are going to try to sort that out. And I think what I'm going to have to do is not try to say much here, except to give you a little preview that, yes, we will deal with it, and we will ask the question, what is the knowledge status of moral claims, and are there ways where you can begin to make distinctions so that you have confidence in when you say this is right or this is wrong? How do you do that? And that will be one of the chief assignments from the course. Yes? Wow, these are really helpful comments and questions. I would say that we've lost our innocence, and there probably is no turning back. I think at this point we can make a deliberate decision, as we did in the U.S. with the supersonic transport, not to develop that technology, and I think we ought to do that more often, make that kind of decision. But I would guess that we probably cannot turn back, because I suspect that even to deal with the problems we've created already, we're going to need more sophisticated science, more sophisticated technology in some ways. And yet in other ways, I think we have to turn back in some respects, in terms of just the quantity of consumption. We're on a trajectory that is just insane in some ways, and I think we will have to find a way to moderate and find other ways to live. Now, a lot of science writers have referred back to the text in Judaism in Genesis where humans are commanded to exercise dominion over nature. And they don't like that text at all. They really just feel that a lot of what's happened in a negative way is a result of Jewish thinking and Christian thinking and domination over nature, and that this is a bad thing. I would suggest that the text in Genesis about humans having dominion over nature is, in the first sense, not a moral judgment at all. It's an empirical fact. As soon as the forebrain begins to develop in the way it does, you will have power over nature as Homo sapiens, whether you want it or not. That's what it means to be a human being, to a large extent, is that your brain is such that whether you want it or not, you will have power over nature. And then the only interesting question is, how do you use it? So I sometimes think that we can't turn back. unless you want to do a frontal lobotomy or something. We have this power. The question is now, could we become more sophisticated and more rational and whatever, more responsible, and decide more often not to use it in certain ways? I think that's the issue. There and then here. Mm-hmm. Adam, I think it's really both. I think, yes, nature fools us, and as someone put it, remember, it's the first half of the ninth inning, but don't forget, nature bats last. In some sense, I think that's correct. And I think it is possible that some horrible plague that may be totally natural or may be partly the result of our doing could wipe us out. I don't think it's going to happen. It could. But I would say, again, the answer is somewhere in the middle. Yeah, nature has tremendous power. But we do, too. I've been told that if you took enough hydrogen bombs and enclosed them in an inch or so of cadmium, that you could kill everything in a matter of a fairly short time. The radioactivity would be lethal perhaps to all life processes. We have enormous power. So I think, again, not in any way to neglect the other. Nature is still very, very, very powerful. And we may see through global warming, or we may see through some new epidemic plagues. So I don't want to downplay that. That's a helpful comment. There was another... yes? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I'm still not seeing how you can separate the two entities.
Ah, it's a wonderful thing about teaching is over the years, it's questions like this that have really gotten me thinking about these issues. You can't completely. The question is, can you to some degree? Are we part of nature? Yes, of course. Are we fully a part of nature? Not so clear. Because if we were, why would we use terms like unnatural and so on? So that, we're going to spend about two or three classes, four classes, exactly on your question or comment. How do human beings relate to nature? In terms of, are we part of nature? Are we fully a part of nature? Are we partly a part of nature? Very tough question. And we'll look at that. We'll look at terms like contrasting the cultural and artificial with the natural, and we'll ask whether it's legitimate to use terms unnatural and so on, because that's very much a part of the equation. I'd like to just stop here. Thank you very much for the comments and questions, and then I want to just make a couple announcements yet. Wonderful quote that I used once before, I think, from Thomas Merton, from his book, The New Seeds of Contemplation. He says, "What is serious to men is often trivial in the sight of God. What in God might appear to us as play is perhaps what he himself takes most seriously. At any rate, the Lord plays and diverts himself in the garden of his creation, and if we could let go of our own obsession with what we think is the meaning of it all, we might be able to hear his call and follow him in his mysterious cosmic dance. We do not have to go very far to catch echoes of that game and of that dancing. When we are alone on a starlit night, when by chance we see the migrating birds in autumn descending on a grove of junipers to rest and eat, when we see children in a moment when they are really children, when we know love in our own hearts, or when, like the Japanese poet Basho, we hear an old frog land in a quiet pond with a solitary splash. At such times, the awakening, the turning inside out of all values, the newness, the emptiness, and purity of vision that make themselves evident provide a glimpse of the cosmic dance. For the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. The more we persist in misunderstanding the phenomena of life, the more we analyze them out into strange finalities and complex purposes of our own, the more we involve ourselves in sadness, absurdity, and despair. But it does not matter much, because no despair of ours can alter the reality of things or stain the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there. Indeed, we are in the midst of it, and it is in the midst of us, for it beats in our very blood, whether we want it to or not. Yet the fact remains that we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity to the winds, and join in the general dance. There are pencils, too, that Carl and Jim have if you need them.